public key crypto too. But as Serge Lang said about elliptic curves once, I could talk for an infinitely long amount of time about DES. This is not a threat. Okay, so we're going to talk about cryptanalysis of block ciphers, and we're going to focus on DES. And one of the reasons we're going to focus on DES is because the cryptanalysis, especially the two techniques I'm going to show you at first, at the end, for cryptanalyzing DES, really were the things that informed the AES design. So we don't have any anti-leap day, so I guess this really is 227.28 rather. So, and I guess that is the 8th. I'm sorry, the 7th. Okay, so I'm going to talk about the analysis of block ciphers, and for almost the entire talk, the block cipher I'm going to talk about is DES, because it's the one, first of all, it was really the first real good block cipher that was publicly known, and as a result, it was the one that was most carefully analyzed. So the first few slides are a reminder. In the lecture, when I described how symmetric block ciphers were constructed, we sort of made reference to an old design principle by Claude Shannon from Bell Labs, and it was basically, you know, complicated keyed invertible functions, which are what cryptographic symmetric ciphers are, can be constructed easily from elementary rounds, and the two things you need to do is provide confusion, that is, some nonlinear function that confuses the input, and diffusion, something that spreads out the information, and then some way to mix keys in. As I said, the great benefit of block ciphers is they're fast. They're fast, reliable, and despite the fact that we have no proofs of their security, it's actually comparatively easy to design a block cipher that's safe. The design principles are fairly well known. Okay, just the iterated style of constructing a block cipher is you have a plain text, some fixed number of bits in DES. Remember, that's 64. Yes?
Sorry to go back just a teeny bit, but you said we have no proof for the symmetric keys.
Yeah, we don't really have a public key either.
Yeah, it's true. I was wondering, though, how would you compare the strength of the lack of proof on one side or the other? Like, it seems to me like from the symmetric side, it's a lot of just jumbling, like, you know, the game with the cups and the ball.
Yeah, that Josh prejudiced you. Yeah.
And whereas from the public key side, it seems like we have more of a mathematical kind of
background. There really is a mathematical background for the symmetric key. I actually think they're very similar. One thing we didn't talk about, and we probably won't get a chance to talk about, it's very easy to deceive yourself with public key ciphers, because then usually people, when they try to prove a public key cipher is secure, make an appeal to some NP complete problem, and as we all know, whether P is or is not equal to NP is unknown. But it's a very complicated thing. You can have NP complete problems which are solvable in polynomial time most of the time. Yeah. And in fact, some of the original public key ciphers, the knapsacks, were broken for that reason. So, you know, I would say they have equally dubious status in terms of proof. And in fact, most of the security, which is why cryptographers go around all the time sort of with their heads in their hands, is most real security is based on a lot of people trying. There's this funny, I don't know if you've read this book on NP completeness by Gary and Johnson, when they first started in 1974, but they open up with why do you care about P equals NP? I'm sorry, why do you care about trying to prove to your boss that you're trying to solve an NP complete problem and that's really hard, so he shouldn't get mad at you? And he said, you know, there's sort of three things you can do. One is to say, okay, I'm just stupid, but that's a bad idea because your boss says, okay, well, I don't want to, you know, I'll just fire you. but the better thing to say is, look, I've proved this is equivalent to a set of hard problems that all these smart people can't solve. And, you know, you feel more secure because, you know, the employment pool is now working against your boss. So I'd say that this proving status is equally dubious. And in fact, most times when there are good proofs, the underlying thing is not useful in practice. So it's interesting, but not useful in practice. There's a tremendous controversy about some sets of security proofs. Indistinguishability, a bunch of stuff. So it's actually quite controversial. And I've heard sort of real honest-to-God cryptographers who do it for a living in tense situations just sort of dismiss all that. So it's really hard to know. Okay, so let's go back and look at DES. You'll come to love this diagram. This is from the original CRIPS 46 publication. DES is a nice block cipher. It actually only had one drawback, and that was its key size, really. And the mechanism for encrypting, which you're now intimately familiar with from a homework problem, is you take the 64 bits, you permute the bits. This is actually turns out to be cryptographically insignificant, but c'est la vie. You break the 64 bits into a left hand 32 bits and a right hand 32 bits, and you do 16 keyed rounds of encryption and then the final permutation. And the 16 rounds are almost identical. The last one's not quite the same as the other, but it's close. And the two cryptographic functions that you use on the keyed rounds are exchange, simply exchanging the 32-bit pairs, and then applying XORing some non-linear function of the other 32 bits and the key. And you do this repeatedly. And one might wonder why that's a safe thing to do, and we're going to find out in gruesome detail. The calculation of the round function, again, is fairly easy for a machine to do, and as you've learned, it's actually a real pain in the ass for people to do. You can't actually, I rarely don't make a mistake when I try to do this. So calculating the round function means taking the non-participating, the non-XORed round, which is 32 bits, expanding it to 48 bits, again, with this fairly trivial expansion, you know, bit 32, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is the first 6 bits of the expansion, and so you just, it's a fairly trivial expansion, and then XORing that with a 48-bit key, and then you have a 48-bit quantity, or 8 6-bit quantities, and you subject each of the 6-bit quantities to a nonlinear transformation, 8 different nonlinear transformations called S-boxes. And that's the confusion part of the round transformation. And then you permute each of the resulting 8 times 4, 32 bits. And that's the diffusion part of the cipher. It's actually, so as an interesting historical sidelight, one of the reasons the DES design was so interesting is that if you try to build a nonlinear function out of less than 6 bits, it's you're in bad shape because there are very few what's called non-affinely equivalent nonlinear functions for less than 6 bits, 5 or 4 bits. And if you have more than 6 bits, like 8, you can just pretty much do things at random, and you're quite likely to luck out on finding a good nonlinear function. So 6 bits is actually an interesting design point because you actually have to be clever about how you pick the nonlinear functions.
So what did they use 8 for then?
I'm sure it was hardware at the time. Don't forget this was designed originally in 74, so, you know, that ROM was expensive then, or Flash, or whatever the hell they used, if they were in a hardware version.
Before, they were probably using a bit slice machine.
And yes, that's right. Yep. So it's purely environmental. So the round schedule, I'm not going to talk about this too much, how the key schedule is developed. There are some attacks I will mention in the key schedule, but it turns out key schedules are typically, if you don't do anything too stupid, not horribly sensitive. Don't really affect it that much. But the key schedule for DES is you take the 56 bits that are actually relevant in the key. You take a selection permutation that breaks those 56 bits into two 28-bit quantities. You shift the quantities on each round by some different shift that's specified in the algorithm. It is important that it be irregular, the shift, that you don't just do 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. That is important for reasons I'll tell you in a minute.
Is that when you say that, you mean that it rotates?
It rotates, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, you don't shift the bits off the end of the thing. That would be bad. And then after each of these shifts, you select 48 bits. Okay, so the first and the absolutely most important attack on a symmetric cipher is exhaustive search. Actually, DES is a little bit worse than most ciphers on exhaustive search, since it has this symmetry property. It turns out that if you take a key and complement it, or XOR all ones, and you take a message and XOR it with all ones, complementing it, it turns out that encrypting that thing is the same, using that encryption function is the same as forgetting about the complements, encrypting it normally, and then XORing the one in. So it turns out, instead of having a search a space of 2 to the 56 keys, you really only have to search 2 to the 55, but it's a relatively minor point. The exhaustive search is exactly what you think it is. You try all the keys till you hit the one. You have a corresponding plain and ciphertext. Incidentally, I am not going to talk about ciphertext-only attacks. In any real cipher, nobody does ciphertext-only attacks. Symmetric ciphers are secure, have to be secure not only from corresponding plain and ciphertext attacks, but chosen ciphertext attacks, and that's really important. Many of the mechanisms we rely on depend on the fact that knowing the encrypted output of one block really doesn't help us too much in finding out the encrypted output of other blocks. Anyway, again, there are 2 to the 56, or 55 if you want to use this complementation, things that you have to check, and eventually you'll hit one where when you encrypt the plain text, you know, with the right key, you'll get the right ciphertext. And actually, there might be a couple keys that work, and you might have to try another one. But that's it. Now,
it's not any different if you don't have the plain text, is it?
So you do, because again, here's this test. You can't do this test. So you have to know the key is the thing you're looping over. You're trying all the keys. You have to have a piece of plain text to encrypt, and the whole check is to see that's equal to some corresponding ciphertext. So you have to know a plain text ciphertext attack for exhaustive search.
But if you knew English text, you could parse all.
But you're getting too sophisticated. But yeah, you could. It turns out you could. And in fact, because ASCII text, is much smaller in size than just pure random binary text, because it has lower entropy, it turns out there are attacks based on that. But forget it. That's over sophisticated.
John, I think most of the early attacks on DES, the exhaustive key searches, were done by just searching through keys and seeing if anything decrypted to pure ASCII, and saying, this must be
it. Yeah, right. But again, that's a little bit of a quirk that people.
Well, so
in the back of the room.
Yep. Is there a question back there? Yeah.
Yeah. I was going to ask. The Feistel algorithm originally had a 64-bit key, and then they went to a 56-bit key for DES.
Yeah. So here's my opinion. This is purely my opinion. The history of this suggests that IBM submitted their design to the NSA, and their original design had a 64-bit key, and it was reduced to a 56-bit key, and the topmost bits were used as parities instead. Now, my own opinion from having tried to analyze DES for a long time is NSA actually, assuming NSA actually had any part of this, actually improved the S-boxes significantly. They actually helped. But the one drawback of DES was the key size. Had the key size been larger, it really was quite a good cipher. We don't know.
I asked Don Coppersmith about this once. Don Coppersmith's one of the principal designers of DES, and he did say that the original design was 64 bits, and they were explicitly cut back to 56 bits by government agencies.
Yeah, I've heard a similar story from Konheim, but again, I wasn't in the room. They're both honorable people, though. So yeah.
I was trying to understand your comment about how all attacks should have a pair, plain text cipher.
Almost all attacks on symmetric ciphers depend on knowing corresponding plain text and ciphertext. In other words, you're given a bunch of information about, here, I've encrypted five blocks. Here are the five blocks I've encrypted. Here's the corresponding output. Go ahead and break it now.
And the point of doing that would be to gain the key so that you can then decrypt all of them.
All actually, of the there's a shortcut. Right. So one way to break the cipher is to discover the key. As we'll find out, I'll point to some attacks where you don't have to discover the key. You can discover some intermediate information, which still allows you to decrypt an arbitrary, you know, block. But either one breaks the cipher.
It just seemed to me unreasonable to expect that, you know, like if you're really trying to perform active out in the field type of decryption, you know, attacking, to exhaustive searching in order to find someone's key, you may not have corresponding plain text.
Right? That's deceptive. Even in World War II ciphers, as we pointed out, there was plenty of corresponding. There was a fair amount of plain and corresponding text. You can't avoid it in a real operational situation. Headers of things. Don't forget the block size is only 8 bytes. It's just unreasonable to think you're not going to have another 8-byte thing that's the same somewhere, you know, that repeats fairly frequently.
Okay. A typical example would be a diplomatic communication that's encrypted that says, release the following statement after a certain date.
Right.
And it's released, and then it can be compared.
Or a header with the date, or, you know, dear sir, you know, there's a million things. So it's really quite, if you design a block cipher which relies on the fact that people don't have corresponding plain ciphertext, just forget it. Plus, many of the modes I talked to you about, the counter mode is an example, really depend critically on the fact that knowing M blocks doesn't really help you know what the, you know, even if you change one bit with the next block, it's going to be.
Okay, so speaking from the point of view of the guy designing the cipher, I understand why you wouldn't want to count on no one having the plain text. From the point of view of an agent trying to decode the thing, you know, maybe.
So, it's very romantic to think of the ciphers being used by an agent out in the field. What the fact of the matter is, these things are used by banks computers, to PCs, and there's one of them. It's.
Okay.
And even in agents these days, they have cell phones that
implement DNS. I was trying to think of some example, but you know, whatever. Yeah. I mean,
that's the old days. That's the old days, not now. Okay. So the practical part of the script analysis, everyone tell you from now on, is actually quite interesting and fascinating. But here's the practical part: if you want to break a cipher or you want to break a security system, the last thing you want to try to break is the cipher. A guy is an idiot if he's using a bad cipher. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen. You want to discover the key. There are many ways to discover the key that don't depend on breaking the cipher. The second best way of finding the key is depending on the user using a poor random number generator to select the key in the first place. That happens far more often than you'd ever expect. So again, I said exhaustive search, 2 to the 56 bit key space. Well, if the entropy of the random number generator output that the user uses is 20 bits, all you have to really try, assuming you do some transformations, is 2 to the 20th possible keys. That's way smaller. Okay?
That's just an example.
That's just an example. I'm not saying that, yeah. And that's basically trivial. You can do that in no time. That's the second biggest problem in using symmetric cipher. By far the biggest is key management. People leave their keys around. The same thing as passwords. They forget them in applications. It's not infrequent. Doesn't infrequently happen that somebody encrypts something. The key is in memory. It gets paged out to disk. One of the things they teach you when you're using security algorithms is always zero out the key at the end. No matter what bad thing happened, no matter what error condition happened, zero it out before you get to the end thing. So discovering the key is almost guaranteed to be easier than doing anything else. So if you ever want, if you're on the comint part of the problem, the breaking part, just find the key. Don't break the cipher. And if you're on the comsec part of the problem, the security part, the most important thing you can do is good key hygiene. Okay, so in practice, symmetric ciphers are said to be secure if there is no known attack that performs better than exhaustive search, or you know, exhaustive search divided by two for expected success. And in fact, most ciphers that are designed now have this property. There is no known attack that's substantially better than symmetric. I'm sorry, than exhaustive search. And that really is that's the proof. Now, it's more like going down a list of things everybody knows how to do and saying, well, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work, that doesn't work. But it actually is
evidence.
Yeah. Okay. So DES described algebraically. It's actually important for some of the things we're going to talk about later. Again, each round of DES, except the last one, which is a little bit exceptional, consists of two very simple operations. And they're both, if you know group theory, involutions. They're both inverses of each other. The first one is you take L, R, and you XOR L with that thing. Okay. Notice what the XOR thing, no matter what F is, depends only on the key and the right-hand side. Right? So if you do it again, if you have this thing and apply this round again, you'll get another F of ER, and when you XOR that in, it'll be zero. So you get L and R back. So it's inverting. And the other involution, which is even simpler, is just swapping the two rounds. Okay. So with this, you can actually write DES in a simple way as this. It's the product of these, and you can forget about the initial and final permutation. It's the product of 15 very comparatively simple transformations. And one way you break DES, in fact, almost all real ways, is discovering what one of those transformations is, and that. Since they're simple, if you can figure out what one of those transformations is, you can discover the key for that, the 48-bit round key for that one transformation, which leaves only 8 bits to guess. You remember you did a homework problem. We described the cipher as something which maps the key space, which is something of the order 2 to the 56, into the permutations of the block, which is of order 2 to the 64 factorial, which is, again, we proved this gigantic, enormous, ridiculously large number. And so the size of that group is huge. As it turns out, though, in group theory, almost all groups, the symmetric group or the alternating group, depending on whether you stick to just even permutations or you allow log permutation, can be generated randomly by picking almost all the time. If you pick two random involutions in a group, they'll end up generating either the whole symmetric group if one of them is odd, or the alternating group, which is a group of one half that size. It's still enormously, gigantically, tremendously large. It's just by accident. What Coppersmith and Grossman proved was that the basic transformations used in DES would generate the entire, in this case, alternating group, because they're even permutations, if you did them long enough, if you applied enough transformations.
Question?
Yeah.
With all of these symmetric ciphers, it seems like we've approached it from the perspective of that we know what cipher is being used already.
We know what cipher, and we know all the details of the algorithm.
How do we know what cipher is being used? Is it easy to do that, or is that
again hard? As a practical matter? I mean, I don't know how many of you guys write software. If you give people two choices, they're not going to be able to decrypt their own messages, because one guy will pick the one guy will pick the other, and they'll get confused. So in operational circumstances, just for ease of use, you're almost always using one. Not only that, if I want to talk to you, I want to remember one of the things we listed as one of the requirements of a cipher, is I want you to have the same cipher as me, otherwise I can never send you a secret message. I have to tell you the cipher in advance. I have to send you a piece of software. That's no good. So in practice, really, there are very few algorithms used, and in fact, in real practice, people use like one or two or three. So if you can break those three, you're at most a factor of three away from breaking any one of the three, right, if you get to pick them. So as a practical matter, again, just forget the advantage you have by keeping the cipher itself secret. Okay, so let's talk about the key schedule. There's a very, very, very simple attack based on DES's key schedule. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for a lot of things. It turns out there are some keys when you encrypt the message and then you re-encrypt it, you get the old message back. And it's actually pretty easy to see why that happens with the key schedule. That's called a weak key when you can do that. So imagine I have a key where C0, the left hand, remember I told you the key was broken up into two 28-bit segments, and they were shifted, and then a permutation of that was selected. Well, imagine the left-hand side, left 28 bits, happen to be all zeros, and the right 28 bits happen to be all ones, or all they could both be all zeros, or they could both be all ones, but let's take the easy case. Well, every time you shift, you're still going to get the same thing back, right? So the permutation is going to end up selecting the same thing all the time, and as you recall, the inverse of DES is DES again with the key schedule reversed. So in fact, for these weak keys, just applying DES again, which in this very particular case is the equivalent of applying the inverse of DES, just gets the message back. There are only very few of these keys out of 2 to 56, so it's not really a devastating attack, but that is one attack. Okay. I'll remind you of one other thing which turns out to be useful in both this and hashes. And we're going to take a break in about, I'm going to go to 1:45 because I want to get through the preliminary attacks so we can get to the linear and differential cryptanalysis. The birthday paradox, which is used to break most ciphers, which is important in both symmetric cryptanalysis and hash cryptanalysis, is that if you have n things, the probability, and you have a random function of those n things, the probability after m of them colliding goes as the square root. In other words, the typical way this is explained is a birthday party. 365 birthdays. So if each of you is a function, a random function that picks a birthday, namely your birthday, now you would think, sort of off the top of your head, since there are 365 days, if I ask everybody in this room, there are about 30 people in the room, you'd think there's maybe a 10% chance that the birthdays would collide, that two people would be born on the same day. Well, it's highly likely, way more than half, that in a group of 30 people, they'll collide. In fact, it's 23. So it turns out that if you have a random selection of n things, when you select roughly the square root of n of them, in other words, you divide the exponent by 2, there's likely to be a collision. Okay, so the next attack is called meet in the middle, and I have to remind myself not to talk about this because I think I was... and there are two versions of meet in the middle. There's one which, it turns out, doesn't happen. So, what is that?
You have a phone?
I do not. Well, not here.
Microsoft.
It could be at Microsoft. You know, you shouldn't have said that thing about Don Coppersmith there, Josh. Okay, so...
it's not me.
It's somewhere at Microsoft, yeah. Okay, anyway. So suppose it turned out you said to yourself, 56 bits, that's crappy. Let's have a bigger cipher. Let's double the number of bits. And let's double it by reapplying the cipher with two different encryption with two different keys. So the way I've designated that is: suppose you had an encryption which consisted of two applications of DES, one with the key A, which is 56 bits, and one with the key B, which is 56 bits. That's 112 bits of key. That's a ridiculously large search space. You might feel safe about that. But suppose DES had the following property, and I told you. Permutations of this kind tend to generate a group. Suppose it turned out that the successive application of two keys was equivalent to the application of one key. again, in group theory, if you take two things and operate on them, and they turn into a third thing in the same set. Well, then it would be, you would have gained no security by doubly encrypting DES, because you don't have to discover A and B. All you have to discover is the effective key, which is still 56 bits, if this thing forms a group. Okay, so you've cut the number of bits in half, or the square root, if it happens that DES formed a group, the keys thing. It isn't. Somebody proved that. There's an equivalent, though, time-memory trade-off attack on DES. Again, you're sitting there going, okay, DES is not a group. I like this idea of having 112 bits of security. I'm just going to apply DES twice. And here's a reason that doesn't give you 112 bits of security. And remember, that's our gold standard. There should be no attack that's significantly better than 2 to the 112th search, or 2 to the 111th expected search. Suppose you have corresponding known, and suppose you have a ciphertext P. So what you can do is, where did I write this here? I didn't write this in the most easy way. So,
again, 111 is an arbitrary number based on our current computing capacity. Is that right?
It's not doubling the key.
No, it's doubling the key. 56.
You double the key, you should have double the protection, but you don't.
Right.
Sure, but the fact that the key is 56 bits in the first place was an arbitrary decision too.
Well, but right? Once you fix the algorithm, so the problem, I'm telling yourself, put yourself in the following position. You're worried that DES by itself is not safe enough.
Okay.
You don't want to go out and buy more hardware, and you don't want to write another big program. So you say to yourself, look, I can make it a lot better by just applying it twice with two different keys. Okay. And so I'm going to show you that that doesn't work so well. And the time-memory trade-off is basically the following. Again, you have corresponding plain and cipher text. You encrypt this single plain text bit with all possible keys, and you get 2 to the 64 of them. Two to the 56 of them, sorry. Okay? And then you decrypt C with a key. They'll collide. There's a good chance that you found the key, you know, the equivalent transformation in that case. So it's a time memory trade-off. You don't get 2 to the 112. You really only get 2 to the 64. Okay? So that's the reason you don't hear much about double DES. You hear about triple DES. It's because double DES doesn't provide much more security. Triple DES does. Okay, I am going to introduce one other attack, two other attacks, and then we're going to break. The crypt analyst's dream is that you're dumb enough to invent a linear cipher. So, again, when you're breaking a cipher, the goal of the cipher designer is to force you into trying 2 to the n things. If the cipher designer, where n is, or 2 to the k things, I'll call it, where k is the key size. If it turns out the cipher is linear, then I don't have to try 2 to the n things. If I have k things, which are linearly independent, I can solve the cipher if it's linear. And solving a problem of size k is a way lot easier than solving a problem of size 2 to the k, even if the basic operation, the 2 to the k, is, you know, significantly more expensive than the k thing. So the simplest way to break a cipher is if somebody's dumb enough to do a linear cipher. And that's even if you have, you've perfectly diffused cipher. The keys are used all, you know, the key bits are spread out.
Okay, that probably said in there somewhere. What's the scenario?
In this case, I think I said, I assumed that when I wrote this that it was an n-bit block cipher and an n-bit key. So n was the size of the block cipher. It could be anything. Think of n as 64 in a modified DES, only two spaces 56. Okay, so you never want a linear cipher. They're quite easy to break, and in fact, you'll break one in the homework. Okay, but you can do something almost as good if you're a cryptanalyst. So you may not find a function which is linear, but suppose you can find a function that has the property that some function that you can figure out of the ciphertext plus some function that you can figure out of the plain text is a linear function of the keys, key bits. Okay? So this thing on the left-hand side is known once you have a known plain ciphertext pair. And the thing on the right is unknown and involves n unknown variables, k1 through kn. But the a sub i's are known as well. But for each one of those known things, it reduces the key space by a factor of 2. In other words, if I figured out key 1, key 2, all the way up to kn minus 1, I can plug it into this equation, find the nth bit with basically trivial cost. So instead of costing the guy to spend 2 to the n time, he's just done 2 to the n minus 1. So for each one of these equations you find, which is linearly independent, you cut the key space by a factor of 2. And in practice, this is the most effective attack, you know, when you factor out all the stuff. Right? Now, it turns out that no cipher designers are stupid enough to have a linear constraint. But it's a little bit like a kid. If you say you can't have your toy, they say, I want your toy. I want the toy anyway. Cryptanalysts are kind of like that. Even if you don't have linear constraints, what cryptanalysts look for is constraints which are almost linear. That is, which are linear constraints which don't hold all the time, but hold a probability greater than 0.5. Maybe even a teensy-weensy bit greater than 0.5. So DES, you can prove there are no linear constraints. In fact, Jim Reason, I did that back when I didn't have gray hair. But we could find lots of constraints that were near linear. I mean, sorry, you know, that were nearly true and that were linear. That is, there's a linear constraint that it holds, you know, 60% of the time, 51.2% of the time, you know, something like that. Okay, this is garbled. And it's very easy to calculate. Why do I do this? It's very easy to calculate, even with these probabilistic constraints that vastly reduce the search space, if you have a probability significantly bigger than 5. And in fact, I'll show you a voting scheme that discovers this. It's also very easy to calculate the probability, once you've had a linear constraint, that some set of n, think of it as a voting thing, so you have n equations and linear equations, some of which are wrong and some of them which are right. But the probability is more of them are right than wrong, because the probability that the linear constraint holds is bigger than 0.5. Even with fairly small sample sizes, like, you know, 1,000 corresponding plain and ciphertext, that can discriminate between keys quickly. And so that's, we'll go through details on this, but that's one of the major ways to break a cipher. The two key ways that actually do work in practice in ciphers, or DES anyway, although only a little bit, are linear and differential cryptanalysis. So I'm going to go to two other things just to quickly. You know what? Let's take a break now. 10 minutes. Okay. So bear with me for 6 slides. For the rest of the presentation, there's a very few mathematical techniques, and I want to introduce some notation and something to get used to stuff. Incidentally, Josh, for your ASCII thing, people would say you should have compressed first.
They say that, but people often don't.
But people often don't.
Lot of the basic challenges, the data challenge, the RSA challenge, are just ASCII text and the challenges.
Yes, right.
Look for ASCII compressions.
Right. Okay, so almost all the techniques I'm going to talk about depend upon this, what I'll call linearization, in 2 different forms. But since I'm talking about functions and polynomials and linear functions, I have to go through some stuff which you can go read about or you can just accept as a matter of faith. You won't actually need to do a problem, but it's important to know these things. So there are a bunch of attacks which don't work, but illustrate how you might attack problems like this. One of them goes to the question you asked. One way to break a cipher is to discover the key. Another way, if the cipher designer is it turns out not to do a good job, is you can imagine that the ciphertext, the cipher bits really, are a function of the plain text bits and the key bits, which is very sparse. It doesn't have very many entries. In which case, you have to solve very few equations to find those coefficients. Even if you don't solve the key, find the key, that will tell you how to encrypt and decrypt from now on. So having a sparse representation and solving for the coefficient of some transformation, in this case a symmetric cipher, and solving for those very sparse coefficients can be an easy way to break a cipher. You might decompose the cipher, and I'll give you an example, if it's possible. That would make it much simpler to solve. You may transform the cipher into a related but not the same cipher. And that, is it possible? That cipher could be much, much easier to solve because it's nearly linear, for example. But in practice, we're going to stick to these two things. So here's the part that's a little bit mathematical, and again, just enjoy it. If you don't get it, it's okay. But here it is. All cipher transformations, in the case of DES, take something which is 64 bits into 64 bits. So imagine each bit is represented by a variable. So the first bit is variable x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, up to xn. Cryptographic transformations, just like any old function, is a transformation from those n, in this case 64 variables, into the new variables, the ciphertext variables. One critical fact that you might not guess off the top of your head is that any function from a finite field, a vector space in this case, can be a finite field, to another finite field can be expressed as a polynomial. But the hitch is if it's a function of, if you have n bits, the polynomial can have up to 2 to the n terms. It's called Lagrange's equation. Lagrange's interpolation theorem. But it turns out every single function, no matter how pathological or complicated, from this finite block to the finite block, can be expressed as a polynomial in those variables. And there's some standard form called the algebraic normal form, which basically is this. You start out with possibly a constant, which would be 1 or 0. Next you have all the linear terms. So it's some constant times x sub I, where x sub I, again, is the variable. Then you do all the binary terms, the product of two variables. Then things with three variables in it, multiply together, 4 or 5. So, and in fact, from this you can actually see there are possibly 2 to the n terms.
What's the operator you're doing on those?
Plus, XOR.
That is an XOR.
XOR, which is the same as plus. I sometimes don't even put the circle around it, because in binary arithmetic, plus and XOR mean the same thing, typically. If you have any of you taken a coding theory class, you're familiar with that. Yeah, actually, you can already see why linear functions are so easy to solve. Is there are only two to the n possible linear functions, but there are two to the n possible generic functions, right? It's a much, much smaller space. The degree of the polynomial you're accustomed to, it's the sum of the number of variables in the term with the highest number of variables in it. Again, squares don't matter, because again, this is the freshman's dream, x squared equals x in a binary field. So it's just the number of terms. Functions of degree 1 are called affine, which means they're either linear or they're linear plus the one constant. You can have one. And as I said, Lagrange interpolation theorem says every function at n variables, where the variables come from a finite field, can be expressed as in algebraic normal form. So that's one thing you need to know. I'm not going to go through the mechanics of Boolean functions, but one thing you would naturally gravitate to is the distance between two linear functions. Between two functions. I have a function from 2 to the n to 2 to the n things. I can write that function as a vector with 2 to the n components and just see how many components they differ by. That's a natural measure of distance between two functions. And in fact, what we often study when we're constructing these affine or linear constraints is the distance of the function from an arbitrary linear function. And it turns out that that's fairly easy to calculate. I'll show you how.
Say it again. The distance is the number of terms in the mapping equation?
No, that are different. In other words, suppose I have a function f, and I have a function g, and it's from n bits into 1 bit. So it's a function from n bits into 0 or 1. Okay? I could write that function as sort of a vector. So this is the value of the function on 0. This is the value on the function of 0, 0, 0, 0, 1. This is the value of the function on 0, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0. Right? I could write that. There are two to the n of those things. And if g maps 2 to the n onto 0, 1, there are two to the n of those things. The distance between these functions, a natural measure of the distance, is in how many places do they differ of those two to the n? They can differ in at most 2 to the n. But okay. And so it turns out, suppose we have an arbitrary function f, and we try all possible linear functions g. If it turns out the distance between one of the linear functions and f is 0, f in fact was a linear function. It turns out if the distance between one of the linear functions and f is small, not too many different places, f can be approximated by that linear function. And that's how you discover affine constraints or linear constraints. Almost all linear functions, so a function is called balanced if there's an equal number of zeros and ones on the output. And actually, it turns out if all you have to do to ensure that a Boolean function will have an equal number of ones and zeros is add a non-constant linear term. That will guarantee they're balanced. Okay, so DES. So let's look at one of the S boxes, and I don't expect you to remember this or know this. But so one question you might ask was, how ugly are the S box functions? And the answer is, well, pretty ugly. They're each bit position. Remember, there are four output bits for each S box. If you look at the first bit of output on the first S box and express that as a polynomial, it's this big horrible mess. And I need to explain the notation. So if I write C times C plus 6 plus 5, 6 plus 4, 6 to save space, that really means 1. C stands for 1. And C doesn't appear at 0. Time plus XOR X6. XOR X5 times X6, XOR X4 X6. So these are highly nonlinear functions, and they're highly nonlinear in two senses. The distance from these functions to linear functions, to any linear functions, is high, relatively high, and they're not simple functions. They have lots and lots and lots of terms in it. You can imagine by cascading lots and lots of terms of complicated functions, you even get horribly more complicated functions. And in fact, if you tried to express the output of DES as a polynomial, it would have too many terms for any computer you would ever have to hold them. It just explodes. The terms explode. Okay, so I was having a brain seizure, actually, when I wrote this particular one. So one other thing you might try, and it doesn't work, and you can try variations of this, is you can say, hey, maybe this encryption function has this weird property that it's the concatenation of two encryption functions, one which just depends on the first half of the bits of the key, and the second which depends on only the second half of the bits of the key. And you can imagine, if you can decompose a cipher into a form like this, it vastly reduces the what you have to search. So, for example, if you had a 64-bit cipher, if the key for the full cipher was 64 bits, and it managed to decompose into two 32-bit pieces, well, instead of having to search 2 to the 64 things, with corresponding plain and ciphertext, you'd really only have to search 2 to 32 there, and 2 to the 32 over there, and 2 to the 32 plus 2 to the 32 is 2 to the 33, which is way, way less than 2 to the 64. There are many variations of the theme. Maybe the P doesn't decompose this way. Maybe the plain text. You can imagine that there's a transformation which takes something and decomposes it this way. It turns out there aren't any good ones, but you know, that's an attack that might seem fairly natural to you. This is the sparse attack. So again, imagine you could write out the ciphertext, each cipher bit, as some coefficient which depends on the keys, but has an unknown dependence on the keys, times products of the plaintext bits. Okay, this is actually, again, would have 2 to the n terms in general, so it wouldn't save you too much. But if it turns out that there are only 3 terms which were non-zero, you could solve these equations. Not solve the key, but find the coefficients of the transformation, and that would break the cipher without discovering the key. Okay, that doesn't work either. So in the business of you know, in exercising this one trick, which is to take a function and make it as close to linear as possible, there are really only 2 mechanisms that are used extensively. One is correlation or transformation. There's a transformation like the Fourier transformation, which is called the Hadamard transformation. And basically, it does exactly what I told you. It measures the distance between 2 functions. And what we're going to do in the Hadamard transformation is measure the difference between the function to all possible linear functions. W can be an arbitrary set of coefficients. Okay, so it turns out for DES, for a 6-bit S box, you can actually perform this transformation and measure how far each bit of the S box is from the closest linear function. And that's in principle how you discover these constraints. Incidentally, the best possible functions, the least linear functions, are called bent functions. They're furthest away from the linear. As it turns out, there's another reason DES is interesting. Many bent functions, despite the fact that they're very far in distance from any linear function, turn out to have quadratic terms. And so they're not that many terms. And so they're not quite as suitable as arbitrary functions for encryption. But it's an interesting fact. Okay, so now the remainder of the time we're going to talk about 2 very specific attacks on DES. One is called differential cryptanalysis, and one is called linear cryptanalysis, which will use the mathematics we've developed. It turns out these are the only 2 known attacks on DES which do, in the case of linear cryptanalysis, significantly better than the exhaustive search. In the case of differential cryptanalysis, a little bit better than exhaustive search. As it turns out, again, historically, differential cryptanalysis was known to the IBM team. And in fact, was a classified technique that I guess the IBM team was asked to keep their mouth shut about. You can see that differential cryptanalysis was known to the IBM team when you study the design rules for the S boxes. The S box design rules are calculated to make differential cryptanalysis as hard as possible. Okay, as in all cryptanalysis, it turns out that people were banging their heads against the wall with DES, and the biggest advance in differential cryptanalysis is when somebody tried to break a non-differential cryptanalysis immune system. And so there was a cipher by Merkel called Kafari, which I guess was one of the pyramid owners in Giza, which was, you know, had not succumbed to any attacks. But with differential cryptanalysis, a fairly small number, and again, 1,500. I'm happy to give you 1,500 corresponding plain cipher texts, and I claim my cipher should still be safe, but not Kafari from differential cryptanalysis. So 1,500 corresponding plain cipher texts and a computer in less than an hour broke the cipher, and that's clearly what you don't want. Let's think about the design. You'd like your message to be secret for 10, 20, 30 years. An hour is not close to that. It breaks differential cryptanalysis. Lucifer, as I told you, was the predecessor to DES. It was much less safe than DES. In fact, my suspicion is NSA's biggest contribution was the design of the S boxes, which were far, far superior than the Lucifer design. But anyway, differential cryptanalysis breaks Lucifer pretty quickly compared to the key size. I put the text here. It broke a cipher called Feel, pretty quickly. And in fact, I think Coppersmith, I don't know if you, I've certainly heard him say, when he saw Shamir attacking Feel with this technique, he said, oh my God, he's discovered the technique, because Feel fell right away. And the thing you want, the thing that really rewards you when you're a cryptanalyst is taking a cipher, which is very hard, applying a new technique and just falls apart instantly. So you value that technique when something like that happens. So once Feel was broken with differential cryptanalysis, the writing was on the wall. Differential cryptanalysis does a pretty good job of breaking 8-round DES. And again, just as background, most of the statistical traces in DES go away at 4 rounds. You get very flat statistics for input and output correlation starting at around 4 rounds. So this extends, you know, this is a big advance. 8 rounds being breakable easily says quite a bit. Differential cryptanalysis is also useful in breaking cryptographic hashes, or at least the non-NP complete problem kind of cryptographic hashes that everybody uses. And in fact, this is the principal technique that was used to break NB4, NB5, and to some extent SHA-1. And this is a little bit misleading. The best DES result lets you break DES with 2 to the 47 out of 2 to the 64 possible corresponding chosen, sorry, more than corresponding chosen plain text blocks, which may not seem like a big deal, but it's definitely better than exhaustive search, and that's the gold standard. So while we would not say differential cryptanalysis destroyed DES, it would certainly be described as being broken by DES because it did, by differential cryptanalysis, because it did better than exhaustive search. Okay. So now we're going to talk about the technique of differential cryptanalysis. And basically what you do is you take corresponding plain and cipher text, but you don't exactly look at how the input of a plain text, the output of a cipher depends on its input. You look at the difference between two plain text that go into the cipher and the difference in two cipher texts that exit the cipher. So in fact, you look at, and this is the notation, actually you can't see the primes. So we have two plain text blocks broken into a left and right hand side, and this is unstarred, so that's one plain text block, and another plain text input block, and the star indicates it's different from this one. Then the two corresponding, and I don't know why that star is there because it shouldn't, the two corresponding ciphertexts. And what we're going to look at is the primed value. In other words, we're going to look at the XOR of the two plain text blocks and the XOR of the two ciphertext blocks. And the differential cryptanalysis technique is to follow that XOR through the iterative cipher. It turns out for a single round, if you look at a single round of DES, the input XOR does not depend on the key, right? Because remember, we took you'd have plain text one, the input to round, and XOR'd with the key, and then you'd have a different input to the round, XOR'd with the same key. And when you XOR those two things, the key goes away. So the XOR of the input is independent of the key, but the key will help vote for the output XOR. And that's the key observation, and you'll see that in a minute. Not to make a pun.
So you have two plain text pairs and two ciphertext pairs.
Yep.
And PL and CL belong to each other?
No, the PL is the left-hand 32 bits of... Yeah, so, I'm sorry. I guess this notation is a little bit confusing. So PL is a 32-bit quantity. PR is a 32-bit quantity. Concatenating together, you get a 64-bit quantity. That's the input plain text. The corresponding output ciphertext is CL, the left-hand 32 bits, and CR, the right-hand 32 bits, 64
okay,
bits
so
together.
You'll
see why I distinguish between the 32-bit pairs in a minute.
You take one pair, one plain text ciphertext pair, then you split each of those in half, basically.
That's the unstarred plain corresponding plain and ciphertext, and then you do that again. for the starred,
which is a totally
different plain text, totally different ciphertext. And what you examine is the XOR of those two.
So isn't the XOR a vector?
Huh?
What's it mean, the XOR of the vector?
The XOR individual components.
Okay, the Y is XOR.
Yeah, so again, yes.
Okay.
Bitwise, or position-wise, you know, 1, comma, 0, XOR 1, comma, 1 would be 1 XOR 1, which is 0, and then 0 XOR 1, which is 1. So it's position-wise XOR. Yeah?
Follow the XOR of the two plain tests through rounds of tests. So if you do the test algorithm itself?
Yes, for each of the things, and then you compare the XOR. You'll see in a minute. We're actually going to go through this in gruesome detail. In fact, maybe I'll... And here's what you study. I'll go through a particular round in a minute. What you look at is an input XOR producing an XOR, an output XOR. And what you study... Now, let's just fix our attention on a single S-box. Just have one round... Not only do we just have one round of DES, we have one round... You know, 1/6-bit quantity we're looking at. What you study, the thing that's non-uniform that helps you figure out the key is this quantity. You take an input XOR, X prime, and an output XOR, Y prime. J is the S box you're studying. So let's just imagine we're studying the first S box, S1. And you form the set which is... S of J applied to this thing, and XOR that with S of J applied to this thing. And notice that this XOR that is just X prime. Okay? And you study the cases where that equals Y prime. So as Y prime goes over all the 16 output bits, you know, the union of these sets should exhaust all 64 input XORs. Okay? This is highly nonlinear, as it turns out. Yeah?
My brain is kind of failing to remember its algebra. Would this be translated to be find the set of all U such that this, you know, U X blah 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 equals Y prime? Because we have X prime
yes.
and Y
so
prime.
So X and Y are given. X prime and Y prime are given. So when you find the set, you find all U. You start at 0 and you go through 64. And you find out when you apply the first S box to U plus that first X prime, which is known, and you XOR that to just S of U with the first S box, you get Y prime.
Okay, so we're basically going through all of them and see if they match Y.
That's right. And so you'll get the set, when you do this, you get, for example, D1 of anything comma that goes to 0, you'll get the set D1 of... some set of things go to 1, and all that. When you union all those sets, you'll get 64, as you'll see in a second, right? Because, not 64, yeah, 64. Or when you union them across the 16 possible output XORs. Okay, and the thing you study, these sets turn out to be not equal in size. Some sets are highly preferred to other sets, and some sets will be empty. They'll have no components, as again you'll see in a second. And the notation Shamir used in describing this was this. Input XOR X prime produces output XOR Y prime with probability P when the size of that set divided by 2 to the M, which is the possible input, their M input bits. Okay, so let's just look at a nice table, which will probably clarify this. And we'll take the first entry. This is the input XOR, which is 0, and this is the output XOR. Well, if the two quantities are the same, which means that the input XOR is 0, the input XOR can only be 0 when the two things are exactly equal, then the output XORs are going to be the same. Because if you apply any old function in the entire universe to two equal inputs, you'll get the same output. That's what it means to be a function. However, let me erase this.
Do you have this question yet?
Yeah.
In the previous slide, U stands for each of the 13 possible quantities that can be fed into the X box or into the S box.
Which does?
U does. U corresponds to each of the 13 quantities.
No, 64 bit quantities. Right, there's 64. There's 6 bits of input to an S box, which means there are 2^6 or 64 possible inputs to an S box. However, there are only 4 output bits, so there are 2^4 or 16 possible outputs. Okay. Now, if the input XOR is 1, in other words, if the two plain texts differ only in their lowermost bit, then the possible output XORs are not, you know, they're not in one place. And in fact, you'll notice some are not possible. You can't produce some output XORs with an input XOR of 1. And in fact, generally about 10 to 20% of the input XORs have no output XORs, which is an important thing. And these are not, the ones that are not zero are not uniformly distributed. Right? So, again, as motivation, and you'll see the exact technique, you can develop an intuition how a difference in the key would vote for one of these highly, you know, irregular output XORs, input XORs. Yes?
Will these always be even numbers?
Yes, they're always even numbers, and the sum of any row will always be 64.
Why are they always even numbers?
Why what?
Why are they always even numbers?
Why are they always even numbers? Input XOR... Oh, because it's symmetric, right?
Oh, right.
Okay, so I'm not going to go through all 64 of these things. Let's actually analyze, differential encrypt analyze. So you should focus on this problem when you're solving the very first homework problem. This will make it nice and concrete. It seems very abstract until you do it on a real problem. So I'm going to do a differential encrypt analysis on a single S-box. And what I need to know is I have two corresponding inputs. These are like the piece of L, piece of R, piece of L star, piece of R star. You saw two inputs and one output XOR. So again, just going back to the motivation, I have a chosen output XOR. I'm the cryptanalyst. I get to make you produce an XOR, encrypt two blocks, which has a designated output XOR, and you're going to pick the X input values that produce that have the input XOR that corresponds to that. So here's a very particular example. Suppose the two inputs, P sub R, are 1. These are all hex, incidentally. All the numbers here are hex. And they're obviously 6-bit quantities, so you'll never see an 8 or a 6 in this digit. So the XOR of these two things, in other words, the input XOR, that thing that we called Y prime, do we call it Y prime or X prime? X prime, Y prime? In my last slide, did I call it X prime, Y prime? Or, hang on. I don't want to confuse you with this.
X prime.
See, I didn't confuse it. Where'd it go? Yeah, so the left one is X. Okay, thank you. You're right. So the thing that corresponds to, God damn it, X prime is 0, 1, and I'm not going to put the X all the time, XORed, which I'll write as plus 34. So the input XOR is 1 XOR 34, which is 35. You do that XOR. And the output XOR is known as D. And again, in their notation, that means input XOR 34 produces output XOR D with some. In this case, the probabilities don't matter, as you'll see in a second. So what I'm going to do is go to my table. I'm not actually going to physically do it now. But remember, I had those table with all possible input XORs and output XORs. And I'm going to look up all the input XORs that produce with 35 which produce the output XOR D. Not all are possible, because remember, it's highly nonlinear. It turns out these are them. These are they. They are these. Right? Okay, I also selected another input XOR, output XOR, that was this. So I have two input XORs and two output XORs. So these, when I looked them up, these were the input XORs that produced those output XORs. Now, I'm going to draw a little picture here with an S-box with six inputs.
Question.
Yes.
When you say you look it up, you got all those, you know, numbers. How do you look up?
Actually, I wrote a computer program which tried all 16 output XORs and all 64 input XORs and noted, you know, where they matched up. I actually have a 64 by 16 table, and there are they're right. So you actually compute them. And the S boxes are small enough so you can do that, right? That's not too hard a thing. I actually, in the homework problem, to give you a hint, I did that for you. I did that computation for you.
Oh, okay. So you give us like a text file, right?
Yes. Okay. That was the text file I produced for you? Yes.
Okay, so just back to the top of the slide. Examples of transformation.
Yes, of this, of that XOR producing the other XOR.
Okay,
and these were the actual things, XORs, input XORs that produced the output XORs.
Right.
So I listed them. I looked them up in the table.
Okay, but they're not the same two examples as the two examples of those.
This one corresponds to that one, and that one corresponds to that one.
So what are the axes on the table then? The vertical axis is the input XOR, right?
Well, I don't see vertical and horizontal.
On the table that you look these.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah, right.
And the horizontal axis is the...
Yeah, this table is just the count. But actually, in the table I gave you, it actually names just the count. You're right. In the table I gave you, it actually, for each input XOR and output XOR, it says whether it's in the set. You'll see in a minute.
So the output XOR is the horizontal axis here?
That's right. So no, the input XOR is this axis, I guess, vertical,
right.
And this is the output XOR. And again, the output XOR, there are 16 possible values from 0 to 15, and the input XOR, there are 64 possible values from 0 to 16.
So given an input XOR and an output XOR, I get one point on that table. Why did you have so many...
Again, there are 10 pairs that produce the same input XOR that produces that output XOR.
Okay.
Again, because we're looking at the XORs. We're not looking at the individual. If you're not doing the XORs, you're following the blocks themselves. You're right. For every one input, there'd be one output.
Yeah. But if I look up 35D on that table, I get 2, right? As opposed to 6, 10 if you have.
35D. Okay, so let's do it. 35D.
So there should be.
Two oh, but this. Yeah, hang on.
So I'm always going to see 2, not 8.
It's 35D. And how many did I have here? Jesus, did I mess this up? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Where did 35 come from? Is I think.
It's that's the input XOR.
But it says 34 up above. So
with one XOR, 31.
When you XOR 1 with 34, you get 35.
Just like 21 XOR 15 is 34.
So I wonder if I copy this table. I'm sure the example is correct, even if I miscopied the table. Okay, D. Hang on. What's it? 1, 2. Let's try 3 and see if it works. It was the input XOR was 34.
Would the function be better, more evenly dispersed, if all of the numbers were the same? The number of the pairs were all the same.
Sorry?
Would the function be more evenly dispersed and difficult to break if the numbers were all the same here?
The
number of pairs.
Yes, it would. And so, for example, if you had a linear function, in this case, linearity works against you. If you had a linear one, they would actually be all evenly distributed because the XOR, which is a linear, is A plus B. F of A plus B is F of A plus F of B. If F is linear?
Yeah. So in that case, it's bad.
In this case, it's bad. So let me finish this example. I actually, during the break, I will figure out why it's a good question. I don't know whether I mislabeled it, but 35 produces D does seem to have a 2 in that column instead of the 8 I'm expecting. I don't know what I...
Right above. Maybe you just lined up right.
It could have been that. It could have been that. I know the example's right.
Okay, so there should be an 8.
So there should be an 8. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, right. There should be 8.
The next one matches.
The next one matches?
The second line matches there.
Okay, good. So I think I was just off the line. Okay, so there are 8 possible input XORs, and 8 possible for here, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 possible input XORs here. Okay, so now here's the nice trick. What I actually looked at is all possible 6-put inputs here and 6-put inputs here with the specified XOR, input XOR, that produce these values. So these values here are the XORs of these, you know, the input of 2 corresponding rounds of DES. Okay? Now, suppose instead of having the input XOR, so I've identified the input XOR. What about the input? If I look at the input, just one of the inputs, and I XOR that, this is the X, actually I should, let me write down the input so that will make it clear. So the input here, we'll call it A, XOR K, and this is B, XOR K. K is the key for that round, right? When I XOR these two, I get A plus B. The K goes away. Okay, this is the A plus B.
John, is this described anywhere?
I'll give you a reference later. So each of these values is a possible A plus B. Now, suppose I happen to know the input suppose I know one of these inputs, the A plus K. Let's see, how do I want to say this? Do it in the next thing. You know what? I want to take a break for 2 minutes because I want to write this out. I'll confuse you if I say the wrong thing. So let's take a... Actually, we're close to breaking. Let's take a 5-minute break. And I'll erase this and do the...
Anybody not get homework that wants to pick it up? Let me just finish writing this. All right.
Basically, there are two reasons why you're losing half. Which one, John?
Right. Okay. Yeah. I think that's a way to understand it. Go ahead.
PL and PL. Yeah. This is PL. This is PL and this is PL star.
Right. Okay. And then you XOR these, and that's okay. And so, the reason I wrote it that way. So this set that I calculated is D sub 1, so the first Xbox, of the input XOR 35 produces the input XOR, output XOR D. You can be my guinea pig. That's what this set is. Okay? So if I take a sample input, which is like a U plus K, and I XOR this with the possible U's that produce this, the P will appear in one of these.
What are
you guys are U's such that? No, these are the... those are the U's, right, such that you get that. And so if I XOR... The P has to be one of those things. The input P. They have to be. So actually, the P, but these are all different values. I have two different sets. When I XOR the inputs on them, the P will appear in both of these sets. Yeah, it's a little bit, actually.
Yes.
So which one?
Number 9. The one that has the fundamental formula.
The D something?
Yes. I just not getting the
place that I know that won't erase again. Yes, it will. In fact, I want to do that. This 7 here.
For the same plain text inside.
That. XORed with each one of these things. It doesn't really matter. So either of them, and you get the same set. Yeah, right. Okay. Right. Yes. Well, 23. 23 is also on both. It's one of those two. Yeah.
You're running on an AMD.
That would help. And you take all possible now you've got two tables. Relatively small number of intersections.
Did we get the linear criminals? Anyway, what time did I say we'd start again? Okay, I'm going to go back to slide because actually it turns out this will help.
Next, I mean, you go, aha, okay.
One of those.
Well, this key and this key.
before, is before the end of the year.
Just elaborate on the X and Y meaning the P.
All right, so are we ready to start again? I think this. Somebody asked a question which I think will clarify it, and if I let me run through it once without asking any questions, so you get the gist, and then you'll be okay. Okay, remember, let me erase this so you can see. I constructed the set D. In this case, in our case, J is equal to 1, because we're looking at the first S box. S box is 1. Okay, and this set is the set of all U such that when I X or the U with the input XOR and apply S to it, and I just apply the S box to U, I get the output XOR. In other words, it's the set of U such that that produced input XOR produces the produced output XOR. It's a set. Forget the count. It's just the set. Okay? Yes?
So U is 8 bit, right?
Is 6 bits.
Six
input bits. To the of the S box is 6 bits. The output of the S box is 4 bits. So X prime and U will both be 6-bit quantities, and Y prime will be a 4-bit quantity. Okay.
And the key of the stage is 4-bit, 6-bit, or 4-bit?
No, 6-bit.
The key
is a 6-bit quantity, because that's the thing you XOR with the input. Okay? Now, the reason this is useful is these sets I've produced are exactly the D1 of 35, comma D. So it's exactly those U's. Okay? If I have an input U plus K, again, this would also be a, right? And I XOR that with all possible each one of these elements of the sets, the key must appear in one of those, because it's these are the U's, and I've just XORed a U XOR K, so that U's cancel. And not all of them, but one of them has to be the key. One of them. Okay? So the key must appear. I did the same thing in two sets, the first set and the second set. The key must appear in both of these sets. There are two numbers that appear in both sets. I hope 23 appears in both sets. So the key is one of those two numbers. That's what differential cryptanalysis is. So I'll give you a reference for this, and I actually might post something on the website to clarify this, but the book by Behom and Shamir, Differential Cryptanalysis, and the paper, Differential Cryptanalysis of DES, has this exact example in it, so you can follow it in the book as well. Okay? Yes?
So, when you say since S1B plus S1K, what are they?
Sorry, what?
You say since S1E plus S1J equal S1K. So what is S1E?
That's U plus K. That's the U plus, one is U and one is U plus K. I'm sorry, one is U plus K and one is U plus the differential input plus K. Or equivalently, one is U plus X prime and one is U. Again, when they XOR, they have to XOR to this 32. There's 35, rather. X.
The equation you wrote out there, could you just kind of read through the end of it? It's U such that S1U.
Yes, it's actually this. It's the one that we did here.
So the textbook you said that is in is not one of the three textbooks on your first slide, right?
No, and in fact, it's easier for you to get it online. Search for Differential Cryptanalysis of DES by Shamir, the long paper. And I think this very example is in it. I might actually write out the whole example for you, since I might have managed to confuse you here, and post it on the website. Can everybody read a PostScript file? Yep. Right now, word file. I'll probably post it as well.
Don?
Yes.
So the setup for this problem is that you have the cryptanalyst has plain text and a ciphertext, and another plain text and ciphertext before and after a single Xbox or S box.
Actually, it's almost that. It's not quite. He has the plain text input, two separate plain text inputs with a given XOR, input XOR, which produces the output XOR. So he doesn't need both ciphertext outputs. He just needs to know the output XOR.
And then he's going to use that. And in this case, it's deterministic because there are only two... there are a limited number of things, but if you had...
it's deterministic, scenario, it's deterministic because this input differential... occurs with probability 1. I haven't introduced any probabilistic things.
Right. So then, in a real example, you'd have to look at the distributions and it might be
exactly.
Many possibilities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And you want to look for the one which had the highest vote, ultimately.
So just that equation, right? What does it say over on the right? It's equal to D?
D, the D is the hex digit D.
And the search space increases exponentially with each additional... option.
You're getting ahead of us. So for each 6-bit input, we're just doing one round for one S box.
Yeah,
so that doesn't include.
But in real life, you would be doing
that's
all
right.
The S
right.
Boxes.
That's right.
Sorry, I missed why the key has to appear in the list at least once.
Because this is the set of all possible pairs of a given that produce a given XOR. Right, that was the definition of the set. If I have a known input, which is A plus a key, XOR a key, and I XOR that with each of these, the A's cancel and I just get left with the key. It's this equation again. Sorry. It's, where did I find that equation? Damn, where is it? It's this equation.
So here, what is X? You have X.
X prime is the XOR of the two corresponding pairs. X is one of the pairs.
So what's the X without the prime then?
It's, remember I said I gave you two plain text inputs. That is unprimed, not XORed. I only gave you the XORed output. So X prime is the XOR of the two corresponding X's. I didn't, X actually should be X and X star. X, XOR, X star is X prime.
Is this the homework question that's going to take 1 hour?
No. Oh yeah, I'm sorry, this is the longest of the homework problem, actually. One should only take 5 minutes. So I will post, I want to get to linear. Yeah.
So this the whole process works because the way it is constructed that it XORs the input with the key and then does the transfer.
Yes.
But you said that the method actually works for other algorithms as well.
The differential one. Yeah, because the key.
But they have to, all of them have to have this property to XOR with the key.
That's right.
Okay.
So almost all, even actually in AES, the round key is XORed with the input and then played straight for the standard technique. Yeah, so it depends on the fact that the input XOR doesn't depend on the key, but the output XOR does depend on the key.
It sounds that it's a generic method, but it is not. It works only for algorithms which have this.
Which have this structure where you XOR in the key, apply a nonlinear transformation, and get an output. Yeah.
But that's used in almost every good symmetric.
It's used in almost in almost all iterated symmetric ciphers. So. I'm actually going to only show you how you might use such a thing in a 3-round version of DES. And again, this is not a homework problem. I just sort of want to show you how this would play out in a real example. Suppose again, this is how DES is written out. Suppose I put an input XOR of 0. So the right-hand, remember, again, the input is L0, R0. These are each 32-bit quantities. The output, I'm going to call L3 and R3. Those are both 32-bit quantities. I'm going to pick a differential. I'm going to pick R0 and R0 star to be equal. So input differential 0. And then I'm going to look at the output differential. Okay? So let's actually follow the equations with DES. And this is why such a thing works. Again, I have known plain text and known ciphertext. If you look at, let's start out with this equation. Because of, let's look at a round of DES here. Let's look at this value. This value will be L1 XOR F of K1 R0, right? That's that. Okay. That comes around here, so it turns out this value here will be equal to that too, right? Did we see that? Because of the way this comes around.
Right.
Okay. I know this input, I know this value and this input and this output XOR because I know L3. So it turns out if I XOR L3 with L1, I'll just get left with that XOR. In other words, where did I do with XORs? Yeah. The output XOR R3, which is known because you have corresponding plane and ciphertext. The beginning of the cipher and the end of the cipher are known. And I XOR that with L0, I'll get this thing. Okay, and again, remember, F is the concatenation of the Xbox outputs with this permutation applied. If I undo the permutation, remember that permutation switched around all the bits in F, I get something known on the left-hand side. I can calculate that because I have input values and output values. I know the P permutation. So what I've reduced this to is I now know the... I've now reduced it to the following problem. I have S1, S2, blah, 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 S8. I've undone the permutation, so I know all the 6-bit inputs, XORs, and 4-bit outputs. Okay, so I'm at precisely the situation where I can apply a one-round differential cryptanalysis, like I showed you in the last slide, to find the keys based on S1 or S2 or S3 or S4. Okay, so this is the basic technique. You chase these diagrams and produce an equation which reduces to a sequence of S-box XORs, and then you apply the technique I showed you before. You're not going to have to do this in homework. You apply the technique to find the probable the keys. In this particular example, again, the keys are guaranteed. They're not probable because I did an XOR with probability 1. When you play this through, you're going to get, in multiple rounds, you'll get multiple probabilities. And in fact, the one thing I do need to tell you for the homework, I'm going to skip all these. Damn, I can't get these to go up. Okay. The XORs I all showed you are things which hold with probability 1. I can also find XORs which hold with probability P. Okay? If I have a series of N of those, the probabilities will multiply. So the probability of it being correct after one thing is just P of 1. After two things, it's P of 1 times P of 2. After three things, it's P1 times P2 times P3. So the probabilities multiply. So get, again, and each of these things vote for a key, but it's not guaranteed. So let me summarize and go to the linear one, which is a little bit easier to understand, and then we might come back with this. The best 16-round attack uses a probabilistic 13-round approximate. Yes.
Are you going to talk at all about how to choose a good input, the happy XOR?
You mean the XOR and the input XOR and the output XOR?
Yeah, I mean, I see you're choosing to make sure that those are certain.
Yeah, I'm actually not going to talk about that because it'll take too long. But it's in the book. You actually, since you're only looking at a one-round XOR, you just pick it to have the best value for yourself. And you usually do one thing. You usually only change one bit in the input XOR. So the normal way you produce these differentials is to leave all the S-box inputs constant and have one input to one S-box change, and then follow that differential through. Because if the XOR, the first S-box changes, after the second round, 2 will change, after the next round, 4 will change, and so on. That's in the book. So I think linear differential cryptanalysis may be a whole 3-hour lecture. I might have tried to do this a little bit too fast. Anyway, if you actually follow one of these probabilistic XORs, you barely get an advantage over exhaustive search. Barely, but you do get one. And if you're a slightly more clever, you can get a little bit better advantage. It turns out, to avoid good differentials, in order to not have an S-box that, you know, you can pick a good value, these are the properties you need, and these were exactly the S-box design criteria. Okay, if you have these design criteria, the input differentials, the probability that an input will produce a non-uniform output are minimized in some sense. So although differential cryptanalysis works, it barely works in DES. It's not really a terribly practical attack for the full 16-round DES. For shorter versions of DES, it actually works pretty well. Each of the components of DES actually affect the ability to have a good differential cryptanalysis. The expansion, without expansion, there turns out to be a pretty good 4-round differential, which can be expanded to the 16-round differential. The permutation significantly affects the possible differentials. And in fact, the order of the S boxes significantly affects the possible differentials. In fact, if you change the order of the S-boxes, you can get a much better differential. So. All right. Now, there's a corresponding attack which doesn't use differentials, which is called linear cryptanalysis, and it works like this. It works a little bit like that example I told you before. Can you find a function of the plain text and a function of the ciphertext for which there's a linear dependence of the key? The answer is no. I told you that. But you can find functions of the plain text and functions of the ciphertext where this equation with that linear holds with probability p bigger than 0.5. You can construct these linear constraints by finding linear constraints in a single round and then propagating them through all 16 rounds. I'll show you how to do that. That won't be as confusing as the differential one. Okay, but so how do you use this? Imagine you had an equation like this, which held with probability p, you know, a little bit bigger than 0.5. How would you use it? Well, you'd collect a bunch of plain and ciphertext. Right? And you, for each ciphertext, you calculate alpha sub p and alpha sub c, and then XOR them. Some of them would be ones, and some of them would be zeros. Right? Because, if there are a lot more 1s than 0, it's likely that sigma of k is equal to 1. If there are a lot more zeros than 1, it's more likely that sigma of k is 0. Okay? That's what you do. As it turns out, obviously, as you propagate the linear differential through around, the probability gets closer and closer and closer to 0.5. You might actually start out, okay, how to do a linear constraint. The first linear constraint has fairly high probability for single S-box, 52 out of 60, 64. By the time you get to the end of 16 rounds, the difference between the probability and 1/2 is like 2 to the minus 21st. Okay? So you have to collect a lot of corresponding plane and ciphertext. But if you collect enough, it will vote. I call this voting for the correct equation. And then you can solve it. It turns out, and you'll need to know this for one of the problems, is if the probability of the constraint holding through all 16 rounds of DES is 1/2 plus epsilon, where epsilon is, you're supposed to think, oh, epsilon is a small number, or 1/2 minus epsilon for that matter, because you can just XOR in a 1, the thing reversed. You need approximately C, some unknown constant, which you can figure out by finding out how it works with a single attack, times epsilon to the minus 2 text to solve it. So in the example I told you, where epsilon was about 2 to the minus 21, that was the bias, this is called bias, you need C times 2 to the 21 plus squared, 2 to the 42 texts in order for this differential attack to work, times C. But actually that turns out to be a lot easier to find than DES. Now, in the book I gave you for linear for differential cryptanalysis, the notation is exactly the same as I've showed you. So you shouldn't have any problem with the notation. The one warning I have is in linear cryptanalysis, for some reason, Matsui decided to switch the notation on everybody in the universe. So where we called things L and R, or P sub L and P sub R, he decided to call them, I think you call them P sub high and P sub low, yeah. And the P of L is in the opposite position of P L before. So if you read Matsui's text, just be aware the bit positions are all different because he decided to count from the right instead of the left. And that can be very confusing. Okay, here's the linear differential. Again, here's a linear constraint. Again, to compute linear constraints, the only way we had to do it effectively is to find a good linear constraint for a single round and then propagate it through. And I'll show you how it propagates through. So you could actually take the S boxes as I've given them to you and calculate this constraint. This notation, the bits are numbered from 1 to 6. The leftmost bit is 1. The rightmost bit is 6. On the input, and again you have a 6-bit input key for the S-box, and the output is numbered the same way. If you look at S-box 5, and I'll say this again, and you take the second input bit, that, and you XOR that with the first output bit, and the XOR that with the second output bit, and you output that, XOR that with the third output bit, and you XOR that with the fourth output bit, it will turn out that you get the second key bit, XOR 1, with probability 52 out of 64. So it's like our dream come true. It's a nearly linear constraint through a single S box, right, with fairly high probability.
And you calculated that just by counting.
For this one, you could actually verify it yourself, right? I told you the input, I told you the output, and now you just have to find a sum of the bits of the output that produce, you know. Yeah, so you can just do this one by hand. Okay, so the next question is, how do these things come together? And I'll show you how they come together. And it turns out they come together by canceling. So I'm going to use that one constraint, I rewrote it here, and I'm going to propagate it through three rounds of DES. And so here's how I wrote this again, x sub 1. The notation here means round 1. X sub 1 means round 1 input, round 1 output, round 1 key. Okay, but now look at what the round 1 input is. The round 1 input for when you know, again, when you have known in plain text and ciphertext is known. X1 is known. It's the first bit in the input to the S box that appeared in P sub R, the right hand thing. Okay? So this thing, X sub 1, the input is really just the input to the entire cipher of the right hand side. It's bit 17 of the entire thing. Okay. The output is a little bit more complicated, but what you can say about the output, which is Y1, is that Y1 equals L0, which is known. That's P sub L. XOR, whatever this thing is called, I'll call that capital T. In other words, the thing we're looking for, Y1, equals this known quantity, L0, which comes from here, plus T. And again, I follow this through. This quantity T is still here. Right, this quantity T was the output of this round. And because of the structure of DES, notice that T XORed with C sub L, which is known because you know the output of this round of the cipher, is Y3. So when I XOR the known L0 plus T and the known CL plus T, the T's cancel. And I get an XOR of two known things, C sub L and P sub L. I wrote it as L0 there, but, right? So I'm going to rewrite this equation in terms of these. And what I say is, for this first round, X sub 1 is that. X sub 2 is that. I just rewrote my T. This notation means bit 3, bit 8, bit 14, bit 25. Okay. In round 3, using this trick I just showed you, I can write X3 as R1 plus this. I get these two equations. Okay. I don't know R1. I do know CL. I do know CR, and the right-hand side are K3, I'm going to leave alone. But look at the wonderful thing that happens. The R1 here in this equation is the same as the R12 here in this equation. So when I XOR these two equations, I get this equation. The only thing that appears in this final equation are the known quantities P sub R, the input plain text on the right-hand side, the known plain input from the right-hand side, the known ciphertext output from the left-hand side of the thing, and the known ciphertext output from the right-hand side. So I have a constraint that I can calculate. I have one of these equations, alpha of the plain text plus beta of the ciphertext, and this right-hand side is just a combination of qubits, a linear combination of qubits. So where you're in precisely the situation you wanted to be with that linear constraint. Okay? Now, you have to chase this diagram yourself and do the calculation yourself. And this is well documented in the slides, so you can follow this calculation. But basically what happens is you get like a telescoping series. The things in the middle cancel out. And you're only left with the input and the output and the qubits. Okay? So that's the three round. Now here's the other thing you need to know, and then you'll be able to do the linear cryptanalysis. Okay. This equation was true with probability P. This equation was true with probability P. What's the probability that the XORed equation is correct? Remember, this was only correct with probability P, and this was only correct with probability P. Well, it's correct with the final probability. If both equations are correct, the final equation has to be correct. What's the probability of both equations being correct? It's P times P. P squared. Okay? But that's not all, as they say in the Dicematic thing. If both equations are both wrong, the equation will also, when you XOR them, they'll both be correct. If both equations are wrong, because instead of getting a 1 XOR 1, I'll get a 0 XOR 0, but those are equal. So the probability that this final equation is correct is P squared plus 1 minus P squared. So the probability of this three-round constraint holding is 0.66. So, how would you solve this linear constraint equation given what I've told you? Well, you take loads of let's say 100 corresponding plane and ciphertext pairs. You calculate the left-hand side, which you can do. You know everything you need to know to calculate the left-hand side. Zero or one will occur more often when you do that. Pick the one that occurs more often. That's quite likely to be correct. In fact, with probability 0.66, that'll be correct. I'm sorry, it's more complicated than that. That's quite likely to be correct based on the fact that the probability resulting equation is 0.66. Okay, so you just assume that then. So now you have a known constant. Constants, I shouldn't use C. Known constant is equal to K1 XOR the third round. These are two different key bits, incidentally. Key bit 26 in the first round is obviously different from key bit 26 in the third round, but I can actually calculate which bit of the input key that was. So now I have the linear constraint I need. So I take a bunch of corresponding plane and ciphertext, I let them vote on which linear constraint is correct, and now I have a linear equation which I can use to reduce the key space by a factor of 2. That's how linear cryptanalysis works. Matsui discovered there are really only 5 basic single round, in fact, single S-box, constraint equations he used, and I listed them all for you. There are 5.
John?
Hey. Yes?
On the previous slide, that constraint that you get, you know now whether that one bit and that other bit XOR to 1 or XOR to 0, and then you use that to reduce the search space. But you don't actually know what those bits are. You just can search half.
Well, are you talking about this? What I know is for, let's say I had 1,000 plain text and ciphertext pairs. Okay? I can calculate this quantity on the left-hand side for each of the 1,000 things, right? Because those are all known. If I know the plain text and I know the ciphertext, I can calculate that left-hand side for each of those. So I had 1,000. Let's say 660 voted for that quantity being 1. There were 660 ones and 340 zeros. So because of the probability, it's likely that the correct answer was 1. Okay, so what I'm going to say, remember, all those left-hand sides, all of them, all 1,000 with probability is, have to be equal to this unknown quantity. So what I then say is, okay, that means this left-hand side, which was voted for as 1, is equal to K1. Do you understand?
Yes.
The left-hand side, you can calculate as long as you know the plain text ciphertext pairs. You pick the one which is most likely, and that... Now you have an equation which is linear in the keys, these key bits, and that reduces the key space by a factor of 2. And the way it does that is the same way I told you originally, is instead of guessing 56 bits, you you guess 55 and you use this equation to figure out the 56th bit. Okay? So again, there are five equations.
What happened to the one with 52 out of 64 that we used before?
Isn't that there? Yes, well, okay. So the equation, it's a good point. So you notice I said the probability is 12 out of 64 here for this first equation, which is how Matsui wrote it. Which means if I XOR in 1, it will happen with 64 minus 12, or 52 out of 64.
So for all those except for the 42, we should XOR with 1.
Yeah, you XOR with 1 and get the higher probability one. Thank you. So those are the five equations. I had a whole long list of doing it with three rounds, five rounds. Let me show you the 16-round version just to show how it works, because I managed to color-code this. If you chase that diagram and use, remember there were five constraint equations I just showed you, which I labeled A through E. If you apply constraint 1 at E in the first round, skip the second round, apply constraint D in the third round, and so on. Here, this is the pattern you use to apply the constraints. You write down all those equations. This is what happens when you write down these equations. You get these equations. These are color-coded for the following reasons. The blue values are equal. Okay? When you write down those equations, by a miracle, the left-hand side of the third round is the same as the right-hand value of the second round because of that switching business in DES. So when you XOR all these equations together, here's what happens. That cancels with that. That cancels with that. This cancels with this and this. This cancels with this. This cancels with this and this. And you keep going, and the only thing when you're done, at the end of the day, all these color equations cancel out. And you're left with this. The black terms. Those are all known if you know the corresponding plane in ciphertext. So when you XOR these equations together, you get the following constraint equation. This function of the plane and ciphertext, which you can calculate given the plane and ciphertext, and this linear combination of key bits. Now, it turns out this thing holds with this probability P equals 1 half plus epsilon. And after 16 rounds, the probability is pretty tiny. It's like point, I'll show you what it is in a minute. Okay? And I actually, the person who asked me how did you calculate these things for differential and linear, I actually put the algorithm in here, although I don't really expect you to, turns out it will take a lot longer to explain that, but you know, there's a procedure. It's basically exhaustive search of individual qubits. So, where is this? So, the equations, those constraint equations, happen with these probabilities. Okay, they're a tiny, itsy little bit bigger than 1 half. And so when you look at that equation, if P is equal to 1 half plus epsilon, and I need C times epsilon to the minus 2 corresponding plane and ciphertext for this vote, right? I'm gonna run a whole bunch of plain text and ciphertext through, and the 1 or the 0 is going to win. If I run enough of these texts through, namely C times epsilon to the minus 2, the correct equation is likely to win.
Now, you say you need that much ciphertext. That's that much, that many blocks of ciphertext?
That many blocks of corresponding plane and ciphertext, both. Yes.
Is that a minus or a plus?
Some of them are minus and some of them are plus. This one's minus, but again, by adding by XORing a plus 1, you flip the sign. So it's the same thing as with the individual constraint equations. Okay, I need to tell you one other technique. So that's actually linear cryptanalysis. It is the most effective technique. It turns out because of DES, there's one additional trick you can use. DES, the encryption, is the same as the decryption, except going backwards. So I actually have two equations, two constraint equations for each single corresponding plane in ciphertext. The one looking at it as plain text coming in and ciphertext going out, the other one is looking at ciphertext going in and plain text coming out. So you get two equations for the price of one. It turns out because the probabilities are so small, the best way to actually attack this is to make, for if you have n rounds of DES, like this is an 8-round example, is you approximate using those probabilities n minus 1 rounds. You try all possible key bits here. The one that's correct will have the highest, will make the final constraint equation the most effective, it's called. Most, hold the most often. So this is called peeling off the last round of DES for this test. And you, again, because DES is symmetric, you can peel off the first round for the same reason. So it's a technique to speed it up. Anyway, DES works, this linear cryptanalysis works better than differential cryptanalysis, and also easier to do, yes?
If that works, peeling off, why don't they use some strategies of it, like binary search, like take 8, break into 2 chunks of 4, or something like that?
Well, don't forget, the only thing you have available is all the way, you can't break up the rounds, sorry, in general, right?
Well, they have you have a percentage on an 8-round DES.
Yeah.
And if you look at just the last 8-round, you probably come up with some other constraint equation that's.
Yeah, so again, similar. You don't have too much latitude. You don't, when you have if I have an 8-round version of DES, I don't have the latitude to look in the middle of this cycle. But I do get to say, I'm going to estimate 7 rounds. I'm going to guess at this round, and I'm going to put them together and get a whole thing. But I don't have the latitude to break it up anywhere, and it just doesn't work because. Instead of having 48 bits of guess, I'll have all the bits below the bisection that I'm guessing and all the bits above the bisection I'm trying to do the constraint on, and it's not effective. That may have not made sense to you, and I can talk to you later, but basically, the first and last rounds are the best you can do. Okay, so that's linear cryptanalysis. I'm going to keep you an extra 7 or 8 minutes because I want to go through the problems. But linear cryptanalysis of the full DES uses 2 to the 43, which is significantly less than 2 to the 64, known, and it's known, not chosen, corresponding plane and ciphertext. And here are the constraint equations. There are two mechanisms. The first mechanism, the 2 to the 47, uses sort of the simple technique of doing these constraint equations all the way through. This 2 to the 43 is a slightly more sophisticated technique that peels off the first and the last round. This is the best known attack. Okay, so just two brief observations. Both linear and differential cryptanalysis depended on your knowing the input to the round function and the output from the round function. So the first thing people did when these attacks were discovered was, let's change DES to make these attacks less effective. And what they did, and it's a technique called whitening, which makes them much harder to pull off, is here's the regular DES key. I add two more 64-bit keys. One I XOR with the output of DES, and one I XOR with the input. In other words, encrypting, when I want to encrypt something, I take the input, I XOR this, I'll call it I XOR the input with this K0 key, I perform DES with the K key as normally, and then this comes out with an output Y, I XOR that output with this output key. That removes my ability to know the first and last rounds, the things that went into those round functions. So that's the way, and this technique is used in many of the AES examples. It's called whitening, and it removes the ability to use linear cryptanalysis, differential cryptanalysis, in a straightforward way anyway. Okay, again, for DES, it turns out, really, linear and differential cryptanalysis are typically not what people do. You can just do exhaustive search. So as machines got faster and faster, they just built, they could just exhaustively search for keys. I listed a whole bunch of other attacks on DES. In practice, rather than using triple des, what people do is, rather than using desx, it has been used in some cases, people actually use triple des. And because of the meet-in-the-middle attacks, that's how you apply triple des. It's a 168-bit key. In fact, that's probably the most common block cipher used now. There is a two-key triple des where the input, the first round key and the last round key are the same. It turns out that that's makes the cipher more vulnerable to a time memory trade-off. So in practice, the triple DES with three different keys is the one used. So it's a 168-bit cipher.
But AES is still a little bit better than triple
DES. I suppose people could argue. AES has three modes, 128 bits, 192, and 256. 256 is probably better. Some people say DES has known attacks on smaller round versions, so it's probably less secure than AES. And other people say, well, AES is so very regular, we're suspicious there's an attack and it just hasn't been discovered. So the answer is nobody knows, but there's no known attack. I neither. Summary in DES, it was a great cipher. They should have stuck with a 64-bit key. It would have even lasted longer. It really was the first big advance in non-classified crypto. If you want to make a better cipher, there are a few things you need to do, which is have next week and the AES competitors. You definitely have to increase the key size. The biggest flaw in DES was the key size. You need to use techniques like pre- and post-whitening to get rid of the differential attack. And it turns out you can find the best linear and differential single-round attack. And you're going to do this as an example. Calculate the probability of how well that would play through the n rounds of the cipher. And if the probability means you need more plain and cipher text that are available, then the linear differential attack can't work. Let me just say that in different words. I showed you a linear attack which required 2 to the 43 because the probability was p equals 1 half plus something times 2 to the minus 21. Suppose the probability was 1 half times times 2 to the minus 37. Then the amount of text would be proportional like 2 to the minus 74. But there are only 2 to the 64 possible corresponding plain and cipher text rounds. So you can't mount that attack if the differential probabilities and linear probabilities are small enough. So that's what happened to DES. I do want to go through the homework problems just for a second. I know I've confused you enough that I want to make sure you have enough information to do this. The first homework problem is to do a single S-box differential cryptanalysis, just like the one I showed you. And I gave you on the website the input XORs, the output XORs, and what produced them. So you have all the information. I will actually post a summary again of that example of the 35 produces D, so you can actually follow that. I actually don't expect this to take an enormous amount of time.
You mentioned both a paper and a book.
Yeah, I'll post those. Yeah, they're both by Behaim and Shamir. Actually, they're almost the same. The book is just a slightly expanded version of the paper.
But the relevant section of the book is available online.
Yes. Yeah. Let's skip two for a minute. Problem three, I actually gave you, this one I expect you to take very little time. I actually told you, here's a cipher. It has a 6-bit key. Here are four linear constraints. If you guess K1 and K3, use these four linear constraints to compute K2, K4, K5, K6. You just have to solve the linear equations. And then I said, well, how does this compare to an exhaustive search of this cipher? Homework four is to follow one of these probability calculations through for a linear cryptanalysis. So again, the trick here is for a linear cryptanalysis, if a round linear constraint equation which holds with probability P1 and the next round holds with probability P2, the probability that the XOR of those two rounds hold is P1 times P2 plus 1 minus P1 times 1 minus P2. It's the probability that both equations are correct plus probability both equations are wrong. And in fact, if you have XOR M equations of linear differential, of a linear constraint, the resulting equation is true if even number of equations is wrong. An odd number of equations is wrong, you're wrong.
Is that box a faulty character or something?
Box.
Yeah, it's one of the slides. Yeah.
Yes, it is.
Should it just be nothing? It
should be nothing on the website.
It is what?
Should be nothing.
Yeah, it should. It
doesn't show up in the slides on the web.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how that got there. It's just an artifact. this equation, although it's actually quite easy, I think I might have you skip equation. God, why doesn't this move? I guess I'm going to have you skip problem four, but let me just describe it briefly so you know what you would have learned had you been able to do it.
All of problem four, which goes on for 4 pages?
No, sorry, problem two. Problem two. Problem two, I never got to explain how you propagate a single differential through many rounds of DES. I never got to explain. It's a shame, but it's true. It turns out, in fact, I'll kind of solve this problem for you. A two-round differential, which is iterative, there's one which holds with probability 1 out of 2 to the 234. So a 16-round version would hold with probability 1 over 234 to the 8th. If you know this differential, this probability, you can calculate how many chosen plain text ciphertext pairs are required for a differential cryptanalysis. And so using this equation, you can calculate how many plain text ciphertext pairs. And if you extend it, if you go through more rounds, so this is n over 2, at some point, the number of plain text ciphertext pairs you would need exceed the size of the cipher. In other words, you need more than 2 to the 64 in DSSP, which means the differential attack won't work if the cipher is that many rounds. So skip that problem, do the other two. Three. And I will post, I'll post that first example of a single S-box differential cryptanalysis.